Kavoye Morich on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Some quick news before we get to our next guest. Unfortunately, a number of musicians and actors are leaving us. Ray Liotta died in his sleep in the Dominican Republic, where he was working on a new film titled Dangerous Waters at age 67. Ray Liotta from Goodfellas and Depeche Mode, that one of the founding members of Depeche Mode, Andy Fletcher, has died at age 60. He was the keyboardist. Cause of death was not confirmed. And I never really listened to Yes, but Yes drummer Alan White has died at age 72, peacefully at home after a short illness. So there they go. And some economic news, not so good. Spanish bank, Bancomer, BBVA, one of the folks out there says basically that the baby boom generation is going to have to sell its house to have a pension. How's that sound? So for all baby boomers, if you want a pension, sorry, you ain't going to get it. You're going to have to sell your house. Where are you going to live then? I don't know. With extended family. So yeah, that's not good. Pew Research has put out a study saying that the last five decades have seen a steady decrease in the share of U.S. aggregate income held by middle-income households, the middle class, basically, that it was in the 70s, 62%. That's knocked down 20%, down to 42%. The middle class is disappearing. As you saw in Spain, you got to sell your house to have a pension. No pension for you. In the U.S., the middle class is declining. The news out of Malawi, the Reserve Bank of Malawi, has just announced a 25% devaluation of the Malawi kwacha currency. I had read yesterday, Zimbabwe, I think, has inflated 131% its currency. So, and we've had the lira hitting, lows, the Indian rupee. There was another one today. I can't even remember. Not yet another currency that hit a low. So definitely not looking good. And we've got in California now, they're threatening mandatory water restrictions if residents don't use less on their own as the drought drags on and the hotter summer months approach. So they're talking about rolling blackouts and cutting electricity in the U.S., now cutting water. Even down here in Mexico by me, they were giving out tickets, I guess. I read a story for people who were filling up the pool for their kids in front of their homes, were getting tickets or something, some kind of warning for using water in that manner. So that's going on as well. First it was wheat and now it's rice. India's protectionist moves spark concern that rice may be next. Any restrictions on rice may exacerbate global hunger crisis. India is the world's top rice shipper, accounting for 40% of trade. They say that rice may be India's next food protectionism target after it restricted wheat and sugar exports. And this could have a devastating impact on global food security as it's an important staple. So the show just continues a lot of trouble there. And if that wasn't enough, we've all heard about problems in the supply chain. It's reported that now supply chain managers are throwing in the towel and quitting. Stressed out supply chain managers are quitting. So I don't think that's going to bode well for the supply chain that already has so many problems. We'll be right back with our guest here on TNT Radio.
News as it happens.
I feel more informed when I listen.
Today's News Talk Radio.
TNT.
All right, it's the Kavoye Morich Show on TNT Radio.live, streaming on YouTube, Rumble, Odyssey, the smartphone app, the website, and you can stream and download the talks afterward as well. Joining us is Oswaldo Zavala, who is professor of contemporary Latin American literature and culture with a joint appointment at the College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. His work explores post-national imaginaries, representations of violence at the U.S.-Mexico border, and the exhaustion of discourses on modernity in the Latin American narrative of the last two decades. Bienvenido, Profesor Zavala.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Should we do this in Spanish or English?
como tú quieras, como tú prefieras, cualquiera de las dos. We can do both.
I think the audience wouldn't be happy. But anyways,
we can do a Mexican American interview.
There we go. Maybe half in English and half in Spanish. Oswaldo and I spoke a few years ago on my Geopolitics and Empire podcast. While I was then in Kazakhstan, now I'm back in Mexico, and you know we talked about your book, which was originally published in Spanish, but it's now freshly available in English. It's called Drug Cartels Do Not Exist, Narco Trafficking in U.S. and Mexican Culture. And I cannot recommend it enough. I would just say everyone go out and buy it right now. It gives you, it's a absolutely, interesting take on Mexico and the narcos. Very thought-provoking with extremely original and unique insights. And it's been a few years since I read the book. But, you know, can you tell the TNT audience about it and how you took to approaching, understanding, you know, the narrative and the mythology of narco trafficking in Mexico?
Absolutely. Well, as you just mentioned in introducing me, I'm a professor of Latin American literature and culture. And a few years back, when I began exploring this issue of the media and literary representations of drug trafficking, I quickly realized that most narratives, most fiction on drug trafficking came up figuring or articulating the same narrative over and over again, you know, the same idea about drug cartels that we all reproduce in daily media, and even spontaneously, you know, in private conversation, you know, the idea that cartels are so powerful and that have evolved so much that they are able to challenge and ultimately defy the state. And this idea then became, central for me to understand how is it that this imaginary came to be. So drug cartels do not exist makes certainly somewhat of a bold claim, but I think I am able to sustain it across throughout the book. That most of what we think and what we say and most of what appears in the creative products that we read or consume, you know, in series and movies and film and music, not only in fiction, are really derivative or byproducts of this official imagination. And so I sought out to test this idea, right, to figure out how is it that official discourse is permeating in most fields of cultural production, right, and guiding the logics of representation of, you know, most fiction or film or all cultural products and also journalism, right, most of journalism in inside and outside of Mexico and how this idea came to be. So this book then approaches the Mexican Chronicles, you know, that became very influential in conducting public opinion about the drug war, and then and all these cultural products that reinforce this idea that a weakened Mexican state is facing the challenge of drug cartels and expanding all over the territory.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And, you know, I think in Mexico, we've got the telenovelas, we've got films like Infierno, I think it was the name. It was a really well-made film from maybe a decade ago, and right. The Perfect Dictatorship, I think. And people abroad watch Narcos on Netflix. And so there's this image then that it's, I guess, that the narcos are well, that, you know, the criminal organizations are fighting, wrestling with the Mexican state and government as well. You know, I always don't forget the U.S. empire and the U.S. military and intelligence agencies as well are, to what degree, I don't know, involved in all of this. But from your understanding, you know, where does the real power lie?
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, I wanted to explore this imaginary because it ultimately ends up justifying the drug war, especially the drug war militarization strategy, mm-hmm. right? That began, you know, more openly in 2006 with President Felipe Calderon, you know, when he ordered this so-called drug war, occupying the military, I mean, the territory through the military in different parts of Mexico, right? North and south and in various states, including my hometown of Ciudad Juarez, right at the US-Mexico border. And so part of the problem is that right at the beginning of the militarization, Mexico, it was in fact living one of its most peaceful years in terms of homicides, right? 2007 was one of the least violent years that we have seen in a number of decades, right? From the entire decade from 1997 to 2007, homicides were declining all across Mexico to the point that in 2007 we had about 8 murders per 100,000 citizens or 100,000 inhabitants in Mexico, which is of course, you know, not at all an extraordinary murder index, right? It's actually, you know, pretty corresponding to the size of the population in Mexico. So murders only spiked and became, you know, a noticeable trend after the militarization, right? So for example, in my city, in Ciudad Juarez, back in 2007, there were about 300 and so murders, maybe 340 murders. For a city of 2 million people, it was not, a preoccupying trend. Also, in 2007, murders were declining as well in Ciudad Juarez, and that descent in murders was broken with the arrival of the federal forces and the federal police that began the militarization in 2008. And after they arrived, their arrival, the murders in Ciudad Juarez went up to over 1,000, you know, and then over 2,500 in 2009, and over 3,000 killings in 2010, which was one of the most brutal years in the militarization. And so what I'm concerned is that we tend to believe, right, that Mexico has been immersed in this wave of violence for a long time, but in fact, you know, it hasn't been that long, you know, since this very worrisome trends began, right? And they coincide with the militarization. And so there's been already several studies journalistically and also in academia showing a direct correlation between the militarization and the increased nationwide increase in murders and violence all over Mexico. And so before we even begin to answer a question of, so what is it that is going on? You know, we need to understand that the militarization appears to be the condition of possibility of the violence in the country.
Yeah, I had interviewed some months ago former Mexican police officer who became famous after appearing on Joe Rogan a number of times and his interviews going viral, Ed Calderon. Again, it's really hard to figure out what's going on, but you know, he was saying that possibly the Mexican military is basically the most important power structure in Mexico and running things. There's talk about, you know, of course, we got an oligarchy. We've Mexican oligarchy. You know, people talk about like a dozen families. We've got a transnational, you know, capitalist elite. I recently interviewed William Robinson, who's done great work on the global police state and global civil war. What's going on with? And I think you've mentioned in the past that this militarization is used sort of as a cover for, you know, other forces to come in to extract resources and other things like this. You know, if you want to keep going down this line, you know, what's going sure. on here?
So I think, you know, one thing that I think helps disentangle a little bit the all this question about drug trafficking in Mexico is that perhaps we need to separate the field of drug trafficking itself, the phenomenon of drug trafficking, the production and circulation and consumption of drugs in Mexico and abroad, and the history of the drug war itself, right? I think there are two different things. When we think of the drug war, we tend to immediately picture, the drug cartels, as we see them in a series like Narcos, all powerful and armed and fighting for turf and corrupting the governing structures, right? But I think, what we're seeing, especially in the series and film and all that, is really a representation of the ideology of the drug war, but not drug trafficking itself, right? Not the phenomenon. So I would like to separate those two first. And then if we focus on the drug war just by itself, and as I mentioned, the drug war as a condition of violence in Mexico, then we need to really look at the long history of the national security paradigm within which the drug war is inscribed, right? So the drug war came as a byproduct of the US national security agenda that focalized drug trafficking as the new national security threat back in 1986, when Ronald Reagan, for the first time, intersected those two, right? So as the Cold War was ending, right, Reagan shifted the international enemy, right, of the U.S. interests from the fight against communism to the drug war. And so in 1986, after this secret directive, he repositioned, right, the drug trade as the new national security threat to the country. And ever since, there was a process of militarizing police in Mexico, of new binational agreements of cooperation, the increased public spending in the armed forces in Mexico to the point that, from 1990 to around the 2000s when President Calderón came to office, our armed forces and our security apparatus in general had doubled up in size. Right. And so as this is going on, right, there's very little proof that the drug trade got more powerful, as they say. Right. I mean, what we can really verify is that our security apparatus grew immensely. And with it, of course, this narrative of the drug trade as being even more powerful in challenging the state. So what is very paradoxical about the drug war narrative is that it happens precisely at the moment when our armed forces are the most prepared, the most equipped, with heavily trained by the U.S., with U.S. presence constantly in our territory through the DEA and the CIA, right, and all these agencies of cooperation, right, and money is flowing from north to south, including, of course, the famous Plan Merida, right, the binational agreement to fund the drug war and equip our armed forces in Mexico. And so what is then very interesting to understand, right, is that as this process is going on, right, there's a second parallel process happening at the same time, which is energy aperture, right? There's a new energy reform narrative happening all across the first two decades of the 21st century. And in particular, during the Obama presidency, there was major emphasis to continue the strategy and the lobbying for opening energy investments in Mexico. And so these two, of course, are happening through Hillary Clinton's Department of State, but it's a long process, right, that involves diplomacy in both fronts, right? So on one side, we're arming the Mexican military to fight the drug war, and on the other hand, we're pressuring the Mexican Congress to open up energy investment for gas, for mining, for oil in different parts of Mexico. And so something that journalists in Mexico, for example, Federico Mastroianni, who's an Italian correspondent living here in Mexico City, my friend Ignacio Alvarado, another investigative journalist, or Canadian journalist Dawn Paley, who has, by the way, a tremendous book that I also recommend. Her book is titled Drug War Capitalism. They all three have argued that the militarization coincides with those with major sites of extraction, right, of oil, of gas, of mining, right? And so if you move across Mexico's map of violence, you would often find that there where the military are deployed, you will find also major extractive industry ongoing, you know, in the exploitation of shale gas, for example, in Tamaulipas by the Gulf of Mexico, in the north, of course, of also in the state of Chihuahua, mining in states like Michoacán or Guerrero, right? And all these different trends tend to confirm over and over, right, that there is definitely a correlation between violence, demilitarization, and extractive industry.
We're going to, and you also mentioned how the entertainment then is used to sort of manage the narrative wittingly or unwittingly, or, you know, make people, when they watch these films like Narcos and other films, meanwhile, something else is sort of going on. We're going to have to take a quick tequila break, Oswaldo. Sure. So everyone, don't go anywhere. Stay here on TNT Radio.
Politically incorrect on TNT Radio.
The very point that we were just touching on there was energy. And the very point we end up with, if we go net zero, is zero improvement in energy, would be my take on it. It's a crazy proposition. There's so many facets to it that make no sense, especially in this nation, when we have all the opportunity to actually do something. When you come back to even creating manufacturing and local production of things, which we have, we've absconded from that particular thing decades ago. But here we have an opportunity in the current, we can see what's happening in Europe. Couldn't we start to do something, forget net zero, and finding out how we can use our wonderful advantage to the benefit of A, this nation, and B, the people who live in it?
Well, I think what's become clear overseas is that there is a trade-off between energy security and that means, you know, affordable and reliable energy.
Mm.
And the sort of the green dream, the net zero dream.
Politically incorrect on TNT Radio.
Nearly every day, we hear dire predictions about climate change from the media establishment, Hollywood, and politicians. They tell us that the world is coming to an end because normal human activity is raising the temperature to dangerous levels. To avoid a hellish apocalypse, they warn us we must immediately change our lifestyles and our very way of life. But are these sensational claims based on solid empirical science? Do the facts line up with the hype? Well, an increasing number of scientists are becoming skeptical. We covered what many of these scientists had to say in our first groundbreaking film, Climate Hustle. From overhyped claims about severe weather events, temperatures, rising sea levels, and even disappearing polar bears, Climate Hustle peeled back the hype and looked at the facts, facts that simply don't add up to any reason for alarm. So this begs the questions. Why would those claiming a global warming catastrophe spread a false narrative? What would motivate them? Why would they try to hustle you? Are they trying to control the climate or you? Well, those are the questions we're going to explore in this film. And the answers may shock you. Order your DVD, Blu-ray, or digital copy today of Climate Hustle 2.
To find out more, go to climatehustle2.com.
St. Joseph's Indian School is much more than a school for Native American children.
It's like a family. Classes are fun here. I am learning about my culture.
Since 1927, St. Joseph's Indian School has provided children the education, health care, and support they need to succeed. To help give our kids brighter futures, learn more at stjo.org today.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else.
Everybody here wants information about what's going on.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We are back from our tequila break. I'm your host, Jorge Moric, here on TNT Radio. We've been talking to Professor of Contemporary Latin American Literature and Culture at City University of New York, Oswaldo Zavala, an author of the absolute must-read book, Drug Cartels Do Not Exist, Narco Trafficking in U.S. and Mexican Culture. You can get it in English now in Amazon and elsewhere, preferably elsewhere before you look to getting it on Amazon. I wanted to switch gears a bit and talk about AMLO. A number of Mexicans I've been talking to here who otherwise would not have voted for Morena, AMLO's political party, have told me AMLO is the least worst president for Mexico in decades. And I think that says a lot. And I've come to, you know, like to an extent, AMLO, I think I would agree with that, because things are so bad in Mexico that you can't really say it's hard to make an advance because things are so corrupt and so bad. But I would agree with the sentiment that he's been the least worst, and he's been pushing back against a lot of stuff to retain the sovereignty of Mexico, whether it's the GMO, the attack from the GMO transnationals trying to take over the corn you know, control of the food or electricity or energy or oil. AMLO has, you know, one man cannot do everything, but it seems like he's been trying to retain Mexican sovereignty. You know, would you agree on that? And, you know, what's your take on the couple of years of AMLO that we've had?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very complex situation. I am, of course, a sympathizer of many different aspects of this government. And I am very critical of others, right? And I believe we have come to already to understand some of the, you know, the aspects that seem to be advancing successfully, but also major failures and questions that were left behind as citizens. So I would begin first saying that you know, when AMLO came to office, he came campaigning with the idea of descaling the militarization, anti-drug militarization, and bringing back civil power to security tasks, something that, of course, you know, was much supported by the public, and perhaps one of the key issues of his campaign, right? That grant that gave him the presidency, and as soon as he came to office in 2019, he seemed to have come close to canceling the drug war, or so he announced in one of his daily conferences that he does out of the presidential office, right? And he announced the end of the drug war. Also, ironically, the same day they were wrapping up the trial against Joaquin El Chapo Guzman in New York, you know, the famous head of the Sinaloa cartel who was being tried for drug trafficking charges and being, of course, the leader of Mexico's largest cartel. So my new book, you know, that the one that just came out in March called La Guerra en las Palabras, I guess you would translate something like a war within words, begins precisely looking at those two issues happening at the same time, right? So the Mexican president calling off the drug war and the Mexico's major drug trafficker in prison and about to be sentenced for life in prison. And so what is very interesting is that, you know, if you look at those two events happening, you would think that, you know, something major was shifting in Mexican politics, and that, in fact, you know, we were about to enter a new phase, hopefully a post-drug war phase. But, you know, unfortunately, what happened was something very different. The same day that President López Obrador was announcing the end of the drug war, the head of the general leading the Mexican Navy announced a new, military operation to fight a new cartel, right, that was responsible of oil theft, what is known in Mexico as huachicoleo, right, which is, you know, the a Mexican term for stealing or oil theft all across Mexico. And what is very interesting is that this so-called cartel, right, devoted to oil theft, functioned pretty much the same way a drug cartel used to work, right? They had, you know, their sicarios, you know, their whole organization. They were, you know, they had armed wings and they're fighting for turf. The exact same narrative was deployed all over again. And then a few years after that, of course, President Obrador also fell prey to President Trump and was pressured to militarize the U.S.-Mexico border to advance U.S. interest in their anti-immigrant policy, right? That Mexico, of course, adopted and became making Mexico a virtual wall, you know, for the U.S. And so those two issues, right, migration and oil theft, quickly displace the drug war narrative, but reposition the militarization, right, for similar purposes. And so what I find very worrisome is that even though in the official discourse we are not supposed to be fighting the drug war anymore, there are other aspects of the current militarization that, even though they're not on the same fighting the same objectives, they end up pretty much occupying the territory and you know, operating in security tasks pretty much in the same way. And so that's one thing. The other aspect of this is that President López Obrador has increased exponentially the presence of the military in different parts of the country. It's not just the north and the southern border, but also the military is now in control of most customs checkpoints, right, in within the territory or overseas. They're also in control of the new Mexico City airport. They're conducting major infrastructure tasks, you know, projects all across Mexico. And so it is very disquieting, right, to see the military, advancing and controlling aspects of the federal government that they never had any hand in before. And as we say this, right, the presence of the military also goes very unaccounted for, right? There's very little surveillance on how these monies are spent, you know, the types of operations, financial operations they conduct, because they're very difficult, very opaque institution within the federal government. And so I do applaud the president, right, for changing or attempting to change the narrative. And we did see some of it resulting in less violence. So for example, when they try to capture El Chapo Guzman's son in Culiacan in 2019, where the operation was called off because armed people came to the streets and threatened to instigate more violence. The president rightly so ordered, you know, the abortion of that operative and let the trafficker go in order to save civilian lives. And I applauded that. But at the same time, you know, the military presence seems to be advancing. There's very little oversight. And we're all left to the question of, you know, what is it exactly, or what is the limit to this process of militarization that only seems to be increasing?
Yeah, I've spoken to some Mexicans and perhaps some guests I can't recall now when we were discussing Mexico. And I think before you had the federal police or in any case, the military doing a lot of things, and AMLO came and, as you said, that, oh, he's going to demilitarize, but then he creates this National Guard and basically right. It just replaces what was there before. So it's as you say,
not only that, the National Guard, you know, ended up, you know, being completely absorbed by the Secretary of Defense, right, by the Mexican Army, right? So they began as a replacement of the federal police, right? And when they were constitutionally created in Congress, the objective was that they would ultimately become a civilian institution, right, that would be fully under civilian control. But, you know, halfway, a couple years, a year after its creation, AMLO pushed for an amendment in the way it was created, the National Guard, to become permanently part of the Mexican army. So he replaced one army with a different name, right, with a different institutional name, but in fact is the same army under the same military power, right?
And as well, I read recently that AMLO disbanded a unit, I forget its name, that worked with the DEA.
Right, Sensible Investigation Unit, I think.
Yes,
Sensible Information Unit. Yeah,
something like this. The Mexican side of me says, I'm not a fan of having like U.S. agencies or U.S. affiliated agencies in Mexico. I don't think they should be here. But then the commander of that unit was caught running drugs, I think, which is just so typical. I mean, any thoughts?
Yes, this is among the good things that I think AMLO has done, right? So he, after, you know, the capture of the former Secretary of Defense, you know, General Cienfuegos, who was arrested in the U.S., and then, you know, sent back to Mexico and ultimately liberated and free of any charge, you know, in Mexico. The Mexican government pushed for, you know, changes in their cooperation terms with U.S. institutions, in particular, the DEA presence in Mexico, right? And so something that he has done, and I celebrate it, frankly, is to limit the presence of the agents, you know, to limit their activities, to limit contacts of agents with Mexican officials without any direct knowledge of the Mexican federal government, right? And but alongside with this, he shut down this Sensible Information Unit, which I believe is called the SIU, which was created by the DEA in Mexico with Mexican officials, but selected and trained by the DEA. And journalists back in the day when this unit was created, back in 1997, immediately, you know, raised red flags, you know, arguing that this had really, in fact, become the permanent branch, Mexican branch of the DEA, right? Like a mini Mexican DEA at the service of the DEA directly. And as you mentioned, you know, the head of this unit was later arrested on corruption charges. But not only that, you know, we have, you know, a long history of documented crimes, you know, torture, kidnapping, irregular activities of the DEA in Mexico, that it was about time, you know, frankly, that a Mexican president put a stop to this. So I do celebrate this. And when you see the DEA complaining in the media that the Mexican government is not cooperating, you know that we are on the right track.
Yeah, that happened, and that was good. But then I'm here in Jalisco under the regime of Alfaro, who I'm Alfaro, not a fan of. Yeah, at all. People call him Kingpin from like one of those comics. he looks like it. But apparently he opened an office here in Jalisco of the ATF, the Alcohol and Tobacco Firearms, U.S. agency. So it's like the whack-a-mole. You shut one down and then another pops up. And I don't know if you heard that news or any thoughts on an ATF office being opened in Jalisco.
Yes. And it's not the only thing happening, right? They just struck a deal in Chihuahua government, in Chihuahua state, with Governor Maru Campos, a PAN party governor, who struck a deal to install thousands of surveillance cameras all over the state that would be monitored from the U.S. side of the border.
That's crazy.
And under the supervision of agencies like the DEA and I think ATF also. And so this is very worrisome, right? Because in fact, you know, this is one way to, you know, make Mexican sovereignty vulnerable. But not only that, politically, it's really rather worrisome also, because it in fact reinforces military operations and just the idea that Mexico is under some type of civil war that ends up legitimizing, you know, all this very dangerous military operations that are not only conducted, and this is what we clearly must differentiate from the federal government side, right? You have plenty of, you know, criminal activity by state police forces. And one example that comes to mind is the famous GOPES, special police of Tamaulipas, right? A special police branch created in the state of Tamaulipas with heavy U.S. training that has been caught, you know, in the middle of major atrocities, right? Including the killing of 19 immigrants in the small town of Camargo in Tamaulipas, or for example, demonstrated false positives, that it's a term that was used in Colombia back in the 90s, you know, when the military would dress civilians as, you know, guerrilla fighters, in our case as narcos, execute them, and then claim that they were killed in a confrontation, an open confrontation with the police forces. And so this is very worrisome, because this is happening, you know, as we speak, right? And so there's also a major complexity, right, when it comes to state-sponsored violence, because you have these different state governors, right, trying to, continue aspects of what we call the drug war, but what is in fact, you know, a state of exception, where armed forces or state police or municipal police engage in all kinds of criminal activity. So you have these two levels, right, of of state-sponsored violence that we must account for. And and as we say this, of course, the federal government is also over and over again engaging in anti-drug operations, right? Even though supposedly the official policy is to stand down and to not continue the drug war. In fact, what happened in Culiacán when they try to arrest the son of El Chapo Guzmán was an operation conducted by a unit, a special unit of the Mexican army that was in charge of kind of like the SIU of the King, the so-called Kingpin strategy, right? And to detain major heads of drug cartels, but that was sanctioned and conducted without any knowledge of the Mexican president. Right. So this is very interesting. Right. So how is it that factions of the military, the federal government, army, and also different state police forces in states governed by the opposition seem to be wanting, you know, the continuation of the drug war? It's really complex because when the homicide index continues, right, violence keeps, being a major problem in Mexico, and especially homicide, we tend to immediately blame López Obrador, right? So what is it that is not working? His policy of standing down, what he calls hugs, not bullets policy on drug cartels. But, the reality is that there's a lot of the violence conducted also statewide, right? In very obscure operations conducted by state police in different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to take our second tequila break now. Don't change that dial. Stick around here on TNT Radio.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. World Economic Forum President Klaus Schwab has said the future is built by the elites at Davos.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Let's also be clear. The future is not just happening. The future is built by us, by a powerful community as you here in this room. We have the means to improve the states of the world.
Yes, that's right. Klaus Schwab announcing to the world that he has the means to improve the world and that they are in charge of your life. Did anyone vote for Klaus Schwab? This is all part of the Great Reset. You will owe nothing and you will be happy. All your food will be delivered by drones. You will not eat meat. You'll have no privacy, but you'll like it. Welcome to Serfdom 2022. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
Using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
As Joe Biden negotiates his way out of the room,
we don't negotiate with the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We are back from the break on our final stretch with Professor Oswaldo Zavala. And again, check out, find him on Twitter. He's got a great Twitter feed, very resourceful, the stuff he posts there. And his new book, just translated in English, Drug Cartels Do Not Exist, Narco Trafficking in U.S. and Mexican Culture. So if you're interested in drugs, drug cartels, Mexico, get this book. If you like watching Narcos on Netflix, get this book. Things do seem to be getting worse here in Mexico. We've got a global economy that's not doing well. And then as a result, you'll have more social unrest, more organized crime. For the first time here where I live in Mexico, I saw a smashed in ATM. I've been living here for over a decade. And in this neighborhood, I've never seen, a smashed in ATM. I'm seeing more migrants, more homeless people, even on the outskirts of the city. Recently, a friend of mine in their coto, in their gated community, there was a shootout. The police killed a criminal, you know, there had been a guy who had been pretending to purchase people's cars. And then when they would meet, he would kill them and take their car. And so they finally got him. But just these little signals that I'm picking up, like, you know, it seems to be happening more frequently, getting closer to home. And then, of course, you know, we're reading about how the narcos or criminal organizations are taking over the avocado industry, farms, water resources, extorting more and more everyday Mexican businesses and entrepreneurs. You know, where do you see things at in the moment and you know, in the future? There seem to be very few solutions.
Right. And I feel this is where perhaps my last book makes I guess the final argument when I think of this drug war narrative, right? We seem to be going back to, you know, a drug war 2.0, right? Where, you know, it's even worse, right? It came back with a vengeance, right? As you mentioned, you know, the drug cartels are being blamed for, you know, avocado contraband, for extortion, for you know, the smuggling of migrants, and all kinds of criminality all across Mexico. And it is true that homicides have not been significantly reduced in this government. It is also true that the you know, the spike in killings seems to have stopped at a certain level, but it hasn't come down as AMLO predicted when he took office. But as we say all this, right, the narrative of the drug war, as I mentioned, you know, it keeps becoming more and more complex, right? So instead of us talking about, you know, how the military has basically virtual control and sovereignty of the country, we keep hearing that it is drug organizations or organized crime that seems to be expanding over the territory. And this is, of course, supported by plenty of social media imagery and videos that are constantly being shown all over the social networks. So you see, you know, the so-called Jalisco New Generation Cartel, you know, distributing food in the middle of a pandemic, or, you know, shooting themselves a video, you know, showing, you know, guns and equipment, you know, claiming to be ready for war, and all kinds of images like that. And so the question that comes to mind is, again, it's how is it that in a country that is so heavily militarized, right, where there's so many extractive processes ongoing, right, and especially in those areas that are most conflicting, right, like, you know, like the state of Michoacán, as I mentioned, or the state of Tamaulipas, or, you know, Sonora and Chihuahua, how is it that we keep hearing of all this violence, and yet, you know, the extractive industry, major business, in fact, you know, continues to operate, right? In fact, the Mexican peso gained some territory, you know, against the dollar, right? I think it came down to 19 pesos for dollar, right? So our economy doesn't necessarily seem to be, you know, in some aspects, you know, on the verge of a crisis in that respect, at least, right, in macro terms. And so I think, you know, one part of the puzzle can be, how is it that we assess this violence, and how is it that we perceive these organized crime groups, right? And one question that has been set forth by some journalists that I agree with is that perhaps we're also leaving the beginning of a new paramilitary era, right, where what we call drug cartels may in fact be, you know, be working as paramilitary groups with a certain degree of loyalty, you know, to the Mexican armed forces. You know, how is it that, you know, in states like Jalisco, you know, that we have such heavy military presence, this so-called Jalisco New Generation Cartel moves so freely, you know, to, you know, post pictures, you know, that could be located with the technology that we have now at hand, and, you know, seem to be, you know, moving so easily from one place to the other. So I think there's a question to be argued about, you know, our understanding of organized crime and how is it that we need to really rethink, on one hand, you know, what is it that we're seeing in these images of these so-called cartels, and how they may perhaps be paramilitary groups working with a certain degree of autonomy, but also perhaps with a certain degree of loyalty to some parts of the military that would want to keep on going with the drug war. That's one thing. The other thing I think that we need to consider more closely and more seriously is that we really need to interrupt the U.S. national security paradigm in Mexico, right? Not just the DEA operating, of course, and conducting operations in different parts of the country, but also, you know, how is it that we can truly distance ourselves from other aspects of U.S. interventionism, in particular when it comes to energy, right? And this is one of the fronts that I happen to agree with López Obrador, right? That we need to claim some form of energy sovereignty in order to really move forward as a nation. And other aspects, for example, you know, the anti-immigrant policy, right, that has been so harmful and so difficult even to fathom, right, when you see the armed forces, you know, detaining people on the northern border, right, trying to cross to the U.S. Now, it's not only heartbreaking, but also illegal, right, in so many fronts. And so I think, you know, there's many questions that are left open that are not reducible, right, to the idea of drug trafficking or to the problem of drug trafficking in the drug war. I think that's the major narrative that keeps being replayed in our national debate. But it's certainly not just a distraction, but as it's being used as a weapon to legitimize the constant presence of the military forces and also, you know, trying to explain the surge in violence that does not seem to be over yet. And so, yeah, so I think those are my 2-3 cents for thought.
Yeah, and like I said, I highly recommend your book and your work because it's very unique and you come from this different perspective. And I think you're really getting close because we're talking about, you know, deep politics and it's really hard to get down to the truth. We try and you're getting close. And it goes back earlier what I said, the Mexican military deep state, as Ed Calderon said. And I totally agree with you, interrupting the U.S. national security state in Mexico. Again, I'm a big fan of sovereignty and each country controlling itself and getting the empire and transnational corporations out. And just using the example of transit police, I had a transit police, you know, my car became illegal here because it had U.S. plates and the transit wanted me to pay a bribe. And I absolutely, I refused to pay the bribe because that was 1 week before I was moving to Kazakhstan. This was years ago. And I told the guy in Spanish, like, take my car, like happily. And he just stared at me like he wanted me to pay the bribe. I'm like, take the car. I don't care. And then he's like, I'll buy it from you, you know? And so transit police and he's illegally driving it around and he had a pocket full of cash, unbelievably. And I have friends that work in trucking and logistics, and they say that the transit police are just stopping trucks left and right and shaking them down. And that's just like so it's the transit police are doing it, the Mexican military are doing it, like, as you say. And so we got a couple of minutes left. I'm just curious. We had AMLO a few months ago propose the creation of a North American Union or Latin American Union based on the model of the EU. I don't know. Not a lot of people have talked about that. I don't know if you heard that or have any thoughts about that.
Well, I did. I mean, very superficially, I did. And I, you know, I think he's always giving this signs of solidarity, especially with, you know, the so-called new left in Latin America, right? And, you know, with Bolivia, Peru, and Chile in mind in particular. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's very difficult to read this president, right? Because he would say something like that one day, and then the next morning he would say, he just said, for example, I think a couple of days ago, that neoliberalism was in fact not a bad model, that if it weren't so corrupted. and you know, he was not joking. He was saying, you know, corrupt, you know, one of his major campaign themes is corruption, right? And so he said, you know, if the neoliberal project were not so corrupted, you know, from the core, it would actually work. He said it may be one of the most perfect models in world history. And of course that sent shockwaves all over the Mexican left, but and it's very disconcerting, right? And of course, he is known for notoriously driving public opinion and public debate every morning from his daily conference. But it's very concerning, right? Disconcerning that he you know, one day pushes for, you know, continental unity, Latin American unity, and on the other, the next day, you know, he seems to be aligning with, the neoliberal front. You know? So it's a very difficult moment. I believe he's under extreme pressure, right, from different aspects of, you know, the geopolitical scene, and in particular, of course, from the U.S. But it's very unfortunate, right, to be unable to really follow through with his projects and whatever it's in his mind.
Yeah, we've got about a minute left. Where are the best places to find you? Where to get the, you know, your latest books? Will the most recent one eventually be translated into English, possibly?
Yes, we're working on a translation. Hopefully, to be printed next year. We're just started, so it's a slow process. But the new book, La Guerra en las Palabras, War Within Words, you can find it all over Mexico, and actually, it's also distributed in the U.S. in Spanish. So you can, it's out with Penguin Random House, and they're selling it also in the U.S. and as an electronic book also. And the new translation of Drug Cartels Do Not Exist is out with Vanderbilt University Press. But you can, as you mentioned, you can buy it in Amazon, but hopefully other alternative, less destructive networks.
Yeah, try not to support Jeff Bezos. It's been great talking to Oswaldo Zavala. That's Oswaldo with a W. Please buy Drug Cartels Do Not Exist. Stick around. We'll be back after the break with yet another guest.